This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to this week's edition of Flashback Friday, your opportunity to get some good review by listening to episodes from the past that Jason has handpicked to help you today in the present and propel you into the future. Enjoy.
Speakers, publishers, consultants, coaches, and info marketers unite. The Speaking of Wealth Show is your roadmap to success and significance. Learn the latest tools, technologies, and tactics to get more bookings, sell more products, and attract more clients. If you're looking to increase your direct response sales, create a big-time personal brand, and become the go-to guru, the Speaking of Wealth Show is for you. Here's your host, Jason Hartman.
Welcome to the Speaking of Wealth Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, where we discuss profit strategies for speakers, publishers, authors, consultants, coaches, info marketers, and just go over a whole bunch of exciting things that you can use to increase your business, to make your business more successful and more passive and more automated and more scalable. So we will be back with a great interview. Be sure to visit us at speakingofwealth.com. You can take advantage of our blog, subscribe to the RSS feed, and many other resources for free at speakingofwealth.com. And we will be back with a great interview for you in less than 60 seconds.
Have you listened to the Creating Wealth series? I mean, from the beginning. If not, you can go ahead and get book one, that shows 1 through 20, in digital download. These are advanced strategies for wealth creation. For more information, go to jasonhartman.com.
Hey, it's my pleasure to welcome Fred Gleick to the show. He is an information marketing expert for about 3 decades now. Some call him the king of content, and he's published over 20 books, I believe, and he's coming to us today from Las Vegas. Fred, welcome. How are you?
Jason, thank you for having me. I'm well.
Well, the pleasure is all mine. Now, most people, when they talk about info marketing, they're the newbies. They've only been doing it since Al Gore invented the internet. I'm being sarcastic, of course. But since the 90s or even since last year, for example, you've been doing this a long, long time, though, my friend.
Yeah, I have. And just to retrace your steps there on Al Gore and inventing the internet, I actually had the pleasure, and it's one of the interviews that I have on my site, fredgleick.com, with a guy named Vinton Cerf, who was, in fact, one of the two people who invented the internet, along with a guy named Bob Kahn. So if you're interested in hearing what the real Al Gore, quote-unquote, thinks of things about information marketing, you can find that interview on my site. I've been doing this, like I said, or like you said, for 30 years. Started off about half that time was offline, and then I was a fairly early adopter getting online and starting at about 96, 97, started to create, market, and sell information for online consumption as well.
Now, when you say information marketing, are you in any particular sort of niche area, or are you any information is information that you're interested in marketing?
Well, what happened was I quickly realized that being a generalist wasn't the way to go. So I picked early on for myself a few different very targeted niches, which started out with the self-storage industry. And then I targeted the catering industry, the video production industry, and a few other very, very targeted niche markets, and created products for those various niches, primarily concentrating on showing those particular individuals how to generate more customers as a blank fill in the blank, either caterer, video producer, etc. So I did not speak to a very general market because I knew that probably wouldn't work, and I don't think it does work in general. So I targeted various niches that I either had a specific interest in myself or had friends that were involved in. So that's how I got started, and that's what I started doing early on.
Fantastic. And so what are some of the things that you've learned over the years with 3 decades under your belt in this industry? Certainly the media has changed quite a bit. You know, we used to use cassette tapes and then CDs, and now it's pretty much digital, but still a lot of CDs around out there. What are some of the things you've learned? I mean, you know, people's taste for information has changed over the years and the way it's packaged and so forth. Tell us about that.
Well, I think that early on when people were online initially, I mean, I can remember a time where people were excited to get email. That shows you how far back. And I mean, you know, you were like, oh, wow, I got some mail. And most of us at the time were probably on AOL. So the You've Got Mail was like, wow, how cool. I've got somebody sending me something.
Well, that's so true. They actually made a movie about it, as you know.
Absolutely. Right? So what I think has changed dramatically is that now people have become extremely savvy / cynical as it relates to any offers that are being made to them online. So I think that being able to establish trust with customers is probably more important now than it ever has been. And without that trust, your chances of success in your market, whatever you choose to go after, is virtually nil.
And there's got to be more than that.
Well, there is. Yeah. I mean, there's certainly plenty more. What I've learned over time is that also, I mean, I recently, I think it's just a couple days ago, I got an order for over $1,000 worth of physical products that I have. And what I've done is I've actually structured my offers to make it so that people would be crazy, except this person, luckily for me, was a bit crazy. I've now structured my offers so that a physical product, I charge anywhere from 300 to 400% more than the downloadable version of that product, because I just want, I don't want to be involved in the fulfillment business sending out physical products. But if somebody's willing to pay me that kind of premium, I'm willing to do it. So another trend has been the movement from physical products to digital products, as you mentioned earlier, and I've seen it. You're right. There are still some people like this particular individual who will want to buy physical products. But the movement to a pure digital, people are now more comfortable because of iTunes and downloading songs, that they're now comfortable downloading information products as well that are audio or video for that matter.
Yeah, most certainly they are. And it's great with all of the different players. You know, even non-techie people can figure that out nowadays. Certainly that's become a lot easier. I guess the first part that's really, really important is having an audience, having a list, if you will. I don't know if this is your area as much, but how do people develop that and get the word out about their products?
Well, let me give you a story sort of to illustrate this. Whenever I do seminars, and I do quite a few live events, both where I'm speaking at someone else's event and I host my own, what will happen is someone will come up to me, as they do every once in a while. I was at a publishing seminar that I do every year, publishingseminar.com. I lucked out and got that URL. But what happens is that when people come up to me at a book-oriented event and they say, hey, I've got the next greatest book, and usually oftentimes it's a diet book. So somebody says, I've got the next greatest diet book. I'm always like, you know, yawning with a big wide yawn. But I always tell the people, the next great diet book is really not very interesting to me or anyone else. But the next greatest dieting book for accountants, on the other hand, would be very interesting, because people tend to try and cast the largest, widest net they can, when in fact, they'd be much better off casting a much smaller, tighter net to trap only those people that they really have a specific affinity for, or a targeted group that they're going after. So that in general, most people's biggest mistake is to try and capture the greatest number of people. But you're right. The key to doing this, and I'll give you an example with one of my clients who's a voiceover expert in Chicago. So he's got a site called voice-over-training.org, and anybody interested in voiceovers should go there. And Bill DeWeese has been able to target a very, very select number of people who are interested in getting in and succeeding in the voiceover business. Now, his list is quite small, yet his profitability is very high, because he's got a very, very targeted group of people that he's going after. So he's not trying to be everything to everyone. So for people listening to this program, this audio, they should really be thinking of, unless they have already a fairly small market, of smalling down whatever market they're going after. Now, the question always becomes, well, how small should you go? And the answer is, well, I mean, you can go very, very small. I remember a guy that I bumped into who had a newsletter going out to the energy market. And I said to him, well, how many people do you have on your newsletter? And he said, 13. I said, wow, that sounds like a fairly small group. And he goes, yeah, it's a fairly small group, but given the fact that paying $200,000 a year for each one of them to get the newsletter, it's fairly profitable. So again, your numbers will always depend on what price you're charging and the size of your niche, but those two things can be manipulated to make it work for any group.
So he's charging $200,000 a year for a newsletter subscription?
He's really? Probably the foremost experts in the energy. I don't know if it's the energy reclamation business. I met him a number of years back. He's based in Washington, D.C., and all of the large energy companies, the Exxons of the world, and all those people subscribe to his newsletter. He is the expert in his field. And $200,000 for those guys, you know, is less than a couple minutes worth of oil.
Yeah, it's probably a couple seconds worth of oil. So that's true. And I know of one company, they have a $95,000 a year subscription service. So it's not as crazy as it might sound on its face, but I just had to point that out. So, okay, so you've talked about like size of the list and stuff. What areas of info marketing do you like? You talked about the markets and, you know, the self-storage and so forth. I heard that. But ebooks, I know you do a lot in ebooks. Do you do Kindle as well? Do you do other e-readers, or are you strictly doing ebooks in the concept of like PDF files on a website? I mean, can you kind of distinguish that for us a bit?
Sure. Well, anytime I do a seminar on the topic of information marketing, I always point out to people that when you have a group, and let's say I have a group of 100 people in the room, I always do the following exercise. I ask people to raise their hands based on which one of four items they would vote on. And the votes are always for what is your primary means of consuming information? What is your primary and preferred method of consuming information? And I give them four choices. I say, how many of you in here, and I ask for a show of hands, would prefer to read information about whatever topic you're interested in learning, and X amount of hands would go up. And then I say, how many people would prefer in this room to listen to get that information and raise your hands? And then I would ask, how many of you would like to watch? And then I finally ask, how many of you would like to experience? And again, even if they're there for a seminar, I say that just because you're here attending a seminar, this may not be your primary or preferred method of learning. So I give them the four, what I call modalities of learning, and it's uncanny how close it gets to being an equal distribution of all four items. So usually in a group of 100 people, there'll be about 25 people who will choose as their primary method of learning each of those modalities. Therefore, if one were to choose to only produce ebooks, you would be alienating 75% of the market. So any intelligent information marketer should be thinking not in terms of should I produce an ebook or should I produce a video or an audio or do a seminar. The answer is yes, 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 and all of the above. So it's important for everyone listening to understand that people prefer to learn using different methodologies, and therefore you, as the producer of information marketing items, needs to understand that and make sure that you satisfy each of those needs. So when you asked earlier, am I producing ebooks? Yes. Am I producing material for the Kindle? Yes. Am I producing audio? Yes. Am I producing video? Yes. Am I doing live events? Yes. Am I doing webinars? Yes. The answer to any question you'll ask me is yes.
Okay. That you are the yes man. Okay, great. So on the Kindle, I've got a question for you.
Sure.
You know, a lot of people are interested in doing Kindle. A lot of people are doing it very successfully nowadays. What types of stuff are you producing for it? Are you producing books that are like $2.99? Are they $9.99? What kind of market and you know, what kind of length of books are those?
First off, let's back up and talk about fact that you say you know of a lot of people who are making good money on the Kindle.
Well, I had one on my show the other day, so you know,
yeah,
they say they are at least.
Well, that's the point, is that I have a line that I use repeatedly, which is the only numbers you should believe are your own, because
fair enough.
Most people tend to exaggerate, but I'm not saying that there aren't people who are making just a boatload of money. But I can tell you what my numbers are.
But I'm going to, just before you go on, I'm going to completely and totally agree with you. In the internet marketing world, it is like hype, hype, hype. So I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, most of the time when I get together with friends and we're in an internet or information marketing environment, when we bump into somebody and hear them discuss their numbers, when we go and when we start headed to the bathroom, we always say to each other, divide by six.
Yeah, not just divide by two, divide by six. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, depending on who it is. So
right.
The answer to your question is that the Kindle provides us with a great market. Now, the thing about it is looking at Kindle as a great example, you have to understand that there's two kinds of revenue that you can produce from your Kindle books that you put up online. And by the way, if people are looking to do this themselves, they go to kdp.amazon.com, and for free, Amazon will let you set up your own little Kindle store. You have a choice of pricing. If you go below $2.99, you're going to have to be giving them 70% of the revenue. Whereas if you stay between $299 and $999, you're generally going to be able to get a 70% split your way. So 70 for you, 30 for them for the most part. So I'd encourage anyone who's putting up Kindle material to put up somewhere in between those pricing points. And in my recent conversation at the Book Expo a month and a half or so ago, I bumped into one of the guys that heads the Kindle program for Amazon, and I said to him, why don't you consider allowing people to take their Kindle materials and put them into a test mode that does some kind of a, you know, Taguchi testing, that's a fancy name for multivariate testing, that allows for people to figure out what is the best price for that book. And he seemed very intrigued. To date, they haven't yet done that. So it's you as a publisher who decides what your price is. But I would encourage everyone listening to test their prices from $299 to $999 to look for revenue maximization. But revenue maximization should not be looked at just in terms of the Kindle revenue generated. The question becomes, when I put a $299 program out there, which, by the way, almost all of my materials sell for $299. Some of them I have priced at $499, but nothing above that price point. And here's the reason. Everything that I produce for the Kindle, and by the way, lengths vary anywhere from a low of about 2,000 words up to a high of 60,000 words, and every variation in between there.
And by the way, can you give an equivalent, you know, and I know it varies, but what's a sort of a paperback book, and how big is that? 2,000 words, I mean, that sounds pretty short. That's like an article.
2,000 words is an article. It's anywhere from maybe 8 to 10 pages. 60,000 is looking at a 240-page book thereabouts. So anywhere from 10 to 240 pages is the kind of material that I'm producing, and pricing anywhere between, again, for me, it's either $299 or $499, but Amazon pricing should be put for anybody listening somewhere between $299 and $999. But my point is that I would much rather sell a lot more of products at $299 because I have embedded in all that material a slew of what I call bounce back offers, in which I get people to buy the product, but I give them tons of other related and tangential products for them to buy by linking to other materials that I have. So that for me, I would be happy if I could move thousands and thousands of Kindle items every month and charge $0 if I could get those things into the hands of people who would then click on the links, bounce them back to my various sites, and have them buy other higher priced products and services. So I look at Kindle as basically you are paying me to generate leads. That's what I'm saying to Amazon.
Mm-hmm, right, right. And that's a pretty good deal that you're getting paid to generate leads.
Absolutely.
No question about it. So in terms of Kindle publishing, should people just go through the Amazon website, the one you mentioned, and publish it themselves? They just upload their Word document, or should they use a service or another company to do it for them? What is the best way to do that?
Well, I mean, not to promote too many. I did a seminar that consisted of seven brilliant individuals. Of course, I considered myself one of them in a seminar that I put up at ebookseminar.com. And at ebookseminar.com, one of the guys I interviewed was a guy named Joshua Talent, who owns a site having to do with formatting your materials for the Kindle store and other, you know, e-readers. I think that for most material, it's sufficient to take and just use Microsoft Word, because most people are looking at this material on a Kindle reader or in some other kind of an e-reader that isn't very sophisticated yet. Now, this may change. I mean, Apple has got their iBook thing that they're doing to make a book look really attractive and be very interactive. But as far as I'm concerned, people listening to this program should not hinder their starting on this journey by trying to get formatting down perfectly. Instead, just use Microsoft Word, follow the Kindle guidelines, and you'll be fine.
Good. So in other words, you can do it yourself. You don't need an outside service, right?
You do not. Now, in the future, I think that this will get more and more sophisticated and easier for us to do. Right now, if you want a really, really good-looking ebook, you probably will have to go to a professional like Joshua to get this done, just because they have a lot more expertise. But I'm sure even that will change over time, making it easier and easier for individuals to make their own books and make them look good.
Right. And one other note on pricing that you mentioned, you explained the different price tiers on Amazon. With Kindle, if you want to do something that is over $9.99. It's interesting how Amazon is really trying to engineer the pricing based on their commission splits with their authors and publishers, because if you go over $9.99, you know, you get a really bad deal from Amazon. So it's actually better to be under $9.99, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, specifically, it's better to be under $9.99 and over $2.99. They have basically engineered it so that you will want to operate in their sweet spot, because they feel, I think, Amazon feels as a company, that ebooks should be between $2.99 and $9.99. The problem is that information has not been conveyed to the traditional legacy publishers, who are still stupid, and I repeat,
yeah, that industry has been so mixed up for like the last 12 years. It's unbelievable that they haven't. What the traditional publishing or the legacy publishing industry, as you say, almost needs is they need another Steve Jobs to come along and fix them, like the music industry, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Agree 100%. Yeah. And they're fine. I mean, because what sense does it make, Jason, for me to be paying less than a dollar less to get the Kindle book, whereas if I order it and I have Amazon Prime, 2 days from now I can get the physical book for like 93 cents more? It makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah, what you're saying makes perfect sense. Now, I must say, there's one weird exception, and it is yours truly. I have about 4,000 physical books, and I'm just sick of moving them every time I move. And so I literally will not buy a book anymore unless I can get it on my Kindle, because I've just decided I'm going completely digital. Now, granted, the guests on my shows, they're constantly sending me books to review, you know, before I have them on the show or even afterwards. But will I buy one? No, I never buy a physical book anymore. I just can't bring myself to do it. If I can't pack it in my iPad or Kindle, I'm not buying it.
You're not alone. I have a number of other friends that have the same philosophy. I guess it's because I'm still operating out of three physical residences around the country. I'm the lucky owner, quote unquote, of three pieces of depreciating real estate around the United States.
Well, that's kind of changing, just so you know.
Yeah, well, the thing about it is that what's happening now is that I still have plenty of room to house those physical books. I agree with you in principle, although there are certain books. For example, I've recently hooked up and I'm doing a site for poker players, and I've bought physical poker books just because I want to go through them. I want to highlight them physically and leave them open on the table when I take notes and make certain things up that make it virtually impossible to use a Kindle reader for something like that, for me at least.
Yeah, yeah. There are definitely some advantages to the good old-fashioned way. So, okay, so we've talked about the book stuff a little bit, but we didn't touch on the other areas. And I just want to do that maybe real quickly before we
sure.
do. You know, if you have any tips for our listeners on how to create audio content in terms of how to package it, price it, size it, present it, whatever.
Sure. Let me go through the other three modalities of learning. And just before I do that, let me direct everybody to my site and click on the red text that says free information marketing training. There, your listeners can get 4 hours of free audio on how to do what I'm about to tell you in a very condensed version. So if they want to learn more about this topic, go to the site, click on that and watch all of the videos and the audios that are there. Listen to those. So let me go through it. First off, with audio, a couple suggestions. Number one, there are three ways to produce an audio program. One is to sit in a room by yourself, record something into a microphone. Option number two is to have somebody do what we are doing right here, an interview format. Option three, record a live event. Options two and three, I would recommend with certain caveats. However, option one, sitting in a room and recording it yourself, do not do it. I don't care who you are. Even if you're Tony Robbins, it's really difficult to keep audience attention when you are speaking yourself alone, solo, into a mic. Don't do it. So instead, find someone who is a good interviewer, like you are, or find an event that you're doing live in which you properly, mic the audience and repeat questions. So you have two options when doing audio that I recommend. Number one, interview style with a good interviewer. Number two, recording a live event, specifically making sure that you mic the audience properly and that you as the presenter repeat the questions. even though they can be heard, it's always a good idea to repeat the questions. Now, before we move on to video, any questions that you have, Jason, on the audio?
No, that makes perfect sense. You know, I cannot stand it when I have purchased, or even if I've taken the time to listen to free live products from some speakers who will remain nameless, and they don't repeat the question, and they've got a bunch of mishmash, they didn't bother to edit it, and that is just so frustrating to listen to, and I'd say the same thing for podcasters. It's just really inconsiderate to your listener, to your audience, to your fans, that you don't make some effort to make your information more digestible to them.
Yeah, and I think that to me at least, you know, I have a slightly different view on the editing, because I literally will edit none of my material. I don't edit anything at all, audio or video, because as it relates to the kind of content that I'm producing, I always use this line. People will always forgive poor production quality. They will never forgive poor content. Now, luckily, I've been teaching for a while, so most of my material is prepared in a very sensible outline fashion in which I go through material in a logical form. Although some people may need that, I've just found the editing to be unnecessary for me. But again, I can see where in certain industries it would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, and let me make that distinction maybe. You know, I don't mean editing the content itself. I'm just talking about editing the sort of wasted time at a live event, like introducing the next speaker and there's a bunch of and glasses clanking and, you know, oh my God, just get this extraneous stuff out of there and let me hear the guy's speech. That's what I want to hear.
It's funny you say that, because we don't, at my live events, we don't have any of what you're just describing. We don't have any of that nonsense, because I just won't tolerate it myself, because I know if I were in the audience, I wouldn't want that. So I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, other tips on the other modalities?
Sure, absolutely. Let's talk about video. First thing is that people, now that everybody is producing videos and putting them up and et cetera, people have gone video crazy. Last week, I took a documentary film course in Santa Monica. So I'm very interested in video for a number of reasons. But one of the things you have to ask yourself when you're producing a video is, does video make sense? If we're talking about golf instruction, the answer would be 100% yes. If we're talking about a lot of other things, video is overkill. When you and I are having this conversation in which we're not referring to certain specific visual elements, it can certainly be acceptable to use audio. So the question becomes, is video sensible? So that's your first thing to start with. If the answer is yes, then remember something that is crucially important, which is video doesn't look good unless the audio works. So people, and this is true in feature films. I had a bunch of buddies up in Vermont that were feature film producers, and they always used to say, your film will look bad if your sound doesn't sound good. So people will perceive your video as poor if the audio doesn't work well. It's a very interesting phenomena, but it's very, very true. So the first question is, does video make sense? Are you really demonstrating something that would require video? If it doesn't need that, then you may not want to produce video, because the last thing that people want is to just look at a talking head. But there will be times where I will take a seminar, and this is why when we're producing, you know, when I'm producing my own events, I have what's called a video switching unit that goes back and forth between showing the speaker and showing the speaker's PowerPoint slides or whatever they're putting up, to try and mix it up a little bit. And if you watch, you know, any television or documentaries, anything that you want, you know, anything that you watch, you want to make sure, and the only exception to this might be 60 Minutes, where the information is so compelling, it only goes on for about 17 minutes maximum, and you see two talking heads talking to one another. But it's really, really difficult for you to keep my attention with just two people talking and not much video movement. So as it relates to video, make sure that you have a visual component, number one, and number two, make sure that the audio is good. Now, do you need to be dealing with fancy $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 cameras? The answer for the most part is no, because in most cases, people will be consuming your video online, to which you're starting to need a high definition camera because everybody else is using it, but it really isn't essential. So again, those are a few things on the video side, and I just learned how to use Final Cut Pro, but I'm a Mac guy, So most materials that your listeners would be needing to produce can be produced just as simply in iMovie. Now, if you're on the PC side, I got to confess, I have no idea what goes on over
there. If you're on the PC side, you're going to have a much more complicated, frustrating life. That's the bottom line.
Our last element is the seminars and the experiential events.
Yeah, live events and experiential learning. Very powerful, obviously.
You got it. So let's talk a little bit about what you need to remember there. And I have a sort of a magical formula, Jason, for seminars and events that I'd like people to listen to and maybe take a few notes on. TR is equal to SR. TR, total revenue, is equal to SR, seminar registration, plus PS, product sales, plus CB, coaching or consulting business. So your total revenue at an event isn't just what you generate from your seminar registration money. It will also include, your total revenue will also include product sales, meaning things that you sell at or at the event or right after the event, and the coaching and the consulting business that results from doing that live event. Oftentimes, I will produce an event that just breaks even on the front end, and that's my sort of my hope, is to break even in terms of seminar registration dollars, but to make my profit from the products that are sold and the coaching and the consulting business that comes about. So that is the magic formula. And again, I've got another site that concentrates just on this and another free course that your listeners can go to at seminarmarketingexpert.com. So if people go to seminarmarketingexpert.com, there's another free course there they can click on to get another 3 or 4 hours of a free course on how to market and promote your own seminars and workshops.
That's fantastic. What a great bunch of resources. You know, I'm looking at your main site now, the one you first mentioned, and boy, just a wealth of information there. Fantastic material. So thank you so much for sharing that with our listeners. Anything you'd like to say just to wrap it up and give out any other resources or websites?
Yeah, well, what I would say is this, is that information marketing is best done with a topic that you yourself are excited about. I think that there are a lot of people out there that are sort of mercenary in their approach to this business, where they do things strictly thinking about the money. This is a business in which you have to have what I call the long view. You have to be looking at this as a 3 to 5 year real business that you're building, not any kind of, if you hear people say you're going to make, you know, you're going to get rich overnight, you might as well just go buy lottery tickets. So instead of doing that, I would suggest that any of your listeners get involved in creating marketing and selling information that they have an enthusiasm and excitement about. Because if you don't, your chances for success will be really, really low. And I would also think that you would want, if you're listening to this program, to go ahead and educate yourself with a lot of the free resources I've given you here. And by the way, I'm not doing this just because I'm a great guy and a nice person. I'm doing this because I understand the concept, and I own a site that I don't have anything up there yet, but I understand a concept called crack dealer marketing. Now, for your listeners who aren't real familiar with the crack dealing operations, let me just educate.
Okay.
A crack dealer will either give away or sell for very cheap crack to their prospective clients to get them hooked. Well, this is what I'm doing by offering your listeners free resources. I'm hoping that I will sell them crack in the form of great information on my sites, get them so interested that they'll keep coming back to my sites, that they will eventually start to actually purchase my materials. So I think that that's how you have to look at things if you're creating a relationship with customers, that it be a long-term one based on providing people with valuable information, understanding that they may not buy immediately, that they're going to buy at some point in time if you over-deliver on the value. And that's what I try and do with everything I put together.
Yeah, and you know, on that note, I think that's a very good philosophy. It's what I do, and it's worked very well for me. And you probably read it, but I recently finished Chris Anderson's book, Free, which was just phenomenal. That was so good. I want to get him on the show. But yeah, that's exactly what you're doing. It makes perfect sense. This is a good kind of crack, though. It's not a bad kind.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, we're talking about the concept, but we're dealing with much, much better information.
Sure. No question about it. Well, Fred, hey, thank you so much for sharing this. I just pulled up seminarmarketingexpert.com. I can't wait to take a look at this one. And keep in touch. You're doing a great job out there, and we'd love to have you back on the show in the future.
Jason, I would love to be your guest again, and thank you very much for having me.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn about investing in and managing income properties for college students, there's a show for that. If you want to learn how to get noticed online and in social media, there's a show for that. If you want to know how to save on life's largest expense, there's a show for that. And if you'd like to know about America's crime of the century, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com. Or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.